keep in spouting random numbers. Not having to do with anything, just off the cuff. She's heard Frank do that several times, more since they've been investigating the Wicker murder. And it probably means nothing, but he's lost weight, and he's so fixated on Coughlin. Don't use that word. Not fixated. Dedicated. He's Wicker's advocate. He wants to give her justice. Only, what if is the right word? 31. Halfway back to Lyons, Jalbert pulls into the cracked and potholed parking lot of an abandoned strip mall. He feels if he doesn't get out of this car and do some counting, he will explode. It's still daylight, and will be until 9 o'clock. Not too far away, a giggle of girls is watching Frozen. "He's running it out," Jalbert whispers. "That son of a bitch is trying to run out the clock on me." Oh, his head. Throbbing. He runs both hands through his arrowhead swoop of hair. On either side of the widow's peak, he can feel tiny beads of sweat. He needs to count. Counting will soothe him. It always does. And when he gets back to his two-room Celebration Center suite, he can run the chairs. He won't be able to sleep until he does. What was once a game to pass the time has become a necessity. He walks from his car to the front of an abandoned pawn shop. 33 steps, which is 17 and 16. He walks back 15 and 14. He walks back to the pawn shop again. 13, 12, 11. The last three baby steps, because that trio totals 36 and it must come out right. He is starting to feel better. 10, 9, 8, and 7 takes him back to his car. He makes a fist and wraps it on the hood 21 times, counting the numbers off under his breath. He can't arrest Coughlin yet. Never mind the county attorney. The KBI director put the kibosh on that. And Jalbert is forced to admit the director is right. The story of the dream is absurd. But without anything else, even that small-town lawyer Edgar Ball could get the case dismissed. Or maybe he wouldn't get it dismissed. If the county attorney was stupid enough to take such a dumb case to trial, Coughlin would be found innocent and couldn't be retried. Double jeopardy. Case closed. Jalbert needs something that will pry Coughlin open so the world can see the psycho beneath those wide-eyed proclamations of innocence. He has to grind. He has to turn the screws. Jalbert decides to walk around the strip mall, counting carefully from 1. He's made it to 26, 351 total, when he returns to the front and sees a highway patrol car, misery lights flashing, parked beside his unmarked Ford. A trooper is using his shoulder mic to call in his license plate. He hears Jalbert coming and turns, hand going to the butt of his Glock. Then he sees Jalbert's KBI windbreaker and relaxes. "Hello, sir. I saw you parked here, and you did your duty. Your due diligence. 26. Good for you. I'm going to reach into my pocket and show you some ID." The trooper shakes his head and grins. "Not necessary. Frank Jalbert, isn't it?" "Yes." He holds out his hand. The trooper shakes it 3 times. Just right for a handshake. "What's your name, trooper?"
"Henry Calton, sir. Are you investigating the dead girl?"
"Miss Yvonne. Yes." Jalbert shakes his head. "Poor Miss Yvonne. I stopped to stretch my legs and think about my next move."
"The guy who reported the body looks good for it,"
Trooper Calton says.
"Just my opinion."
"Mine too, Troop. But he's hunkered down." Jalbert shakes his head. "Kind of laughing at us, to tell you the truth."
"I hate to hear that."
"We have to grind. Find a way to turn the screws."
"I'll let you do your thinking," Calton says. "But listen, if I could do anything to help, I know it's unlikely."
"Not that unlikely," Jalbert says.
In this world, anything is possible. 16. Calton frowns.
Pardon?
It's a sweet number, that's all. Speaking of numbers, give me yours.
Calton eagerly. You bet, sure.
He takes a KHP card from his breast pocket and scribbles the number of his personal on the back.
You know, I was thinking about applying to KBI myself.
How old are you? Jalbert takes the card.
24.
8 tripled, good. Want some advice? Don't wait too long. Don't put it off. And have a good night.
You do the same. And if I can, you know, help in any way.
I'm going to keep that in mind. Might give you a call.
Trooper Calton pauses getting into his car and looks back with a grim little smile. Get him, Inspector.
That's the plan. 32. At his hotel, Jalbert stops at the front desk and asks if they have folding chairs. The clerk says he believes they do in the hotel's business center. Jalbert asks the clerk to send 3 up to 521.
On second thought, I'll get them myself, Jalbert says, and does just that. There's a dozen or more leaning against the wall, so he takes 4. 4 is a good number. Better than 3. Hard to say why, but even always beats the dickens out of odd. He takes 2 in each hand and carries them to the elevator, ignoring the clerk's questioning look. He unfolds 2 in the small sitting room and 2 in the bedroom. He now has 8 chairs, the bed and the toilet seat count. 1 to 8 inclusive makes 36. 1 to 24 inclusive makes 300. 1 to 40 inclusive makes 820. People wouldn't understand. Most people, but it's really a beautiful thing. A kind of from-the-top-down pyramid scheme that pays dividends not in money, but in clarity. As he nears the end of his 5th round of chairs, he knows what his next step must be.
He folds up the chairs he's brought from the conference room and stacks them next to the little desk. They may come in handy. He takes his suitcase out from under the bed and opens it. From the elastic pouch, he takes a pair of thin rubber gloves and puts them on. Time to grind. Then he calls Trooper Calton. Time to turn the screws a little more.
33.
Early on Friday morning of the week from hell, Danny is awakened by a loud metallic thud, followed by the rev of a car engine with either a bad muffler or no muffler at all. The clock on his nightstand says it's 2:19 a.m. He gets up, grabs the flashlight he keeps in case of power outages, and goes to the front window of his sitting room. Nothing is stirring out there except for a cloud of moths circling a pole light standing tall between the park's office and laundry. Oak Grove, where there are no oaks, is fast asleep. That loud thud has awakened nobody but him, because it was meant for him. Danny opens the door. He sometimes forgets to lock up at night, but he supposes that after Plain's truth and Jalbert's little show in the IGA last night, that will have to change. He goes down the concrete steps and clicks on the flashlight, searching for the source of the thud. It doesn't take long. There's a divot in the trailer's aluminum shell just below the frosted bathroom window. Danny surmises it was the window his nighttime visitor was aiming for. There's a smear of red in the deepest part of the divot. Danny runs his light down the side of his trailer, and there on the gravel is a brick. Wrapped around it and secured with a twist of wire is a note. Danny knows what it's going to say, but squats and pulls it free anyway. The message is short, written in either black crayon or a felt-tip pen. Get out, you fucking murderer, or else. Danny's first thought on reading this is, not on your life. His next is, oh really? Is this a movie? Are you Clint Eastwood?
standing here at 2 in the morning with a threat in one hand and the brick that delivered it at his feet. Getting out of Manitou seems not only reasonable, but attractive. His friend Becky, a friend with benefits, is through with him. She'll keep sweet little DJ away from him, as if he has the bubonic plague, and he's lost his job. Bonus attraction, it seems like half the town has COVID. He doesn't much like the idea of being driven out like Cain after he murdered his brother, but this trailer park is nobody's idea of Eden. It might be time to give Colorado a try. He thinks Stevie would like that. He wonders if that noisy car he heard going away was Pat Grady's Mustang. It might well have been, but what does it matter? Danny goes inside and back to bed, but first he locks the trailer's door. 34. On his last day as an employee of the Wilder County School Department, Danny is moving books from the storage room to the teacher's lounge, which serves as the de facto history and English departments. The books will be stacked there, ready to be passed out to students when school recommences in September, by which time Danny Coughlin hopes to be far away from Wilder County. Jesse comes jogging up the hall from where he's been scrubbing baseboards in the new wing. He meets Danny outside the library and says, "Just a heads up. That cop from the other day is coming to see you. The one with the funny..." Jesse rubs two fingers on his forehead, indicating Jalbert's widow's peak. "He parked around back." "Is the woman with him?" "No, by himself." "Thanks, Jesse." "Guy's really got a hard-on for you, doesn't he?"
"I'll come down and help you as soon as I get these books offloaded."
Jesse persists. "He's not going to arrest you, is he?" Danny cracks a smile at that. "I don't think he can, and it's driving him crazy. Go on now. Let's make our last day a good one." Jesse goes. Jalbert is in the lobby, once more examining the trophy case. He has what appears to be a rolled-up newspaper in one hand. "Maybe he means to spank my nose with it," Danny thinks. That's a welcome ray of amusement in the dread he feels at seeing Jalbert again. He knows dread is exactly what Jalbert wants him to feel. Danny would change it if he could, but he can't. He starts down the hall just as Jalbert comes through the door.
"Did you have a nice fourth?" he asks.
Danny doesn't bother with that.
"What are you doing here on your own?"
To his surprise, Jalbert actually answers the question.
"My partner's daughter is sick. Too much cake and ice cream, she thinks. I need you to come to Great Bend this afternoon."
"Am I under arrest?" Jalbert shows his pegs.
"Not just yet. I need you to give an official statement. For the record, all about the dream you had. Once your dream becomes public knowledge, I'll bet you can get on TV. All the publicity you ever dreamed of. Too bad Jerry Springer is dead. You'd fit right in with the whores and deadbeats."
"Accusing me of being a publicity hound when you're the one who leaked my name? That's pretty fucked up even for you."
"It wasn't me," Jalbert says, still smiling. "I'd never do such a thing. Must have been one of your neighbors."
Danny could tell Jalbert one of his neighbors, or maybe it was Pat Grady, threw a brick at his trailer last night. Could even show him the note. It's in his pocket, but that would be fruitless. Instead, Danny asks Jalbert why he waited so long to ask him to make a report.
"Because you were hoping for something better, right? Not a statement, but a confession. Only your bosses wouldn't find my confession very satisfactory. Think about it, Inspector Jalbert. I don't know where she was stabbed, or how many times, or what with."
"You were in a kill frenzy," Jalbert says.
He believes in Danny's guilt as fervently as Danny's late mother believed in Christ the Redeemer.
"It's common with homicidal maniacs. That's an old term, probably, not politically correct, but I like it. It describes you perfectly."
"I didn't kill her, just found her." Jalbert shows what's left of his teeth.
"Tell me about Santa Claus, Danny. I love that story."
"I don't punch out until 4,
which means I can't be in Great Bend until 6:30 if I keep to the speed limit, which I intend to do.
I'll wait for you. Ella Davis, too. Or you could punch out a little early, it being your last day and all.
Danny is so tired of this man.
I thought you might also like to see this.
Jalbert unrolls the newspaper. It's the Oklahoman.
Jalbert turns to an inside page and hands it to Danny. The story is headlined, "Murdered Girl Comes Home." There's a photograph. It's what Jalbert wanted him to see. Danny thinks it's the real reason Jalbert came.
The picture shows all anyone needs to know about human grief in a single image. Yvonne Wicker's father is holding his wife, whose face is buried in his shirt. His head is cocked skyward. His mouth is pulled down in a grimace. The cords stand out on his neck. His eyes are squeezed shut. Standing behind them, next to a long black Cadillac with Hearst Mortuary on the side, is a young man in what appears to be a high school letter jacket. He's wearing a baseball cap. The brim obscures his lowered face. Danny guesses it's Yvonne's kid brother. Danny thinks he's looking at something the movies and TV dramas rarely express or even comprehend. The human toll. The hammer of grief and the stupidity of loss. The wreckage. His eyes fill with tears. He looks down at the picture and the headline, "Murdered Girl Comes Home," then up into Jalbert's face. He's astounded to see the man is smiling.
"Oh, look, the murderer cries. It's like one of those Italian operas."
Danny almost hits him. In his mind, he does hit him, smashing Jalbert's nose to one side and sending blood down on either side of his mouth and a red Fu Manchu mustache. The only thing that holds him back is the knowledge that Jalbert wants that. He wipes a hand across his eyes instead. "At least tell me her folks don't know about the dog. At least tell me that much."
"No idea," Jalbert says almost cheerfully. "I was not the informing party. That was a detective from Oklahoma City. My job is working the case, Danny, which means working you."
Danny is still holding the newspaper. It's crumpled.
He smooths it out and holds it up for Jalbert to see. "Do you want to see another mom and dad in a picture like this? Because whoever killed her may not be done. He could get two or three more while you're fixated on me."
Jalbert recoils as if Danny has waved a hand in his face.
"I'm not fixated. I'm dedicated."
"I know you did it, Danny. There was no dream. You didn't need a dream to go where she was buried because you buried her. But let's agree to disagree. Be in Great Bend by 6:30, or I'll put your name and plate number out to KHP. Bring your lawyer if you want, and you can keep the newspaper. You might like to gloat over what you did to her family. 4 vics for the price of one." He turns, the tail of his black coat flying, and walks back toward the lobby.
"Inspector Jalbert."
He turns, eyebrows raised, smooth skull on either side of that weird widow's peak as pale as cream.
"Do you grind your teeth?"
Jalbert's brow furrows.
"What?"
"Your teeth. They're all worn down. Maybe you should get one of those rubber dams. They sell them in Walgreens."
"My teeth are hardly the subject under discuss.
Does it help when you count?"
For the first time, Jalbert looks really rocked back on his heels.
"I looked that up this morning before I came to work," Danny says. "It's called arithmomania. Do you do that? Do you do it when you wake up in the night because you're grinding your teeth?"
Also, for the first time, Danny sees a vein pulsing in Jalbert's right temple. Ticka, ticka, ticka. "You killed her, smart boy. We both know it, and you're going down for it." He leaves. Danny stands where he is, crumpled newspaper in hand, trying to get himself under control. Each encounter with Jalbert is worse than the last. He wipes his eyes with the arm of his work shirt. Then he goes back to moving books.
Last day. Do it right.
35. At lunch, he goes out to his truck for his phone. He owes Margie a call. Needs to tell her that he's lost his job and Kansas has lost its charm, at least for him. He's thinking about Boulder. She'll understand that. She likes Stevie. If she needs money, he supposes he can part with a little, but not too much. Until he gets a job, he'll be living on what he's got. Besides, she's getting married, right? He opens the passenger door, reminding himself he also needs to pay Edgar Ball, and gets his phone out of the glove compartment. He starts back to the school, head down, checking for text messages, then stops. He's thinking about something Jesse said. He parked around back. Why would Jalbert do that when the faculty parking lot is the one closest to the school? Danny can think of one reason. He goes back to the Tundra. He gives the truck bed only a cursory glance. It's empty except for his toolbox, which he keeps padlocked. The cab, on the other hand, is unlocked. He always leaves it unlocked, and Jalbert would have seen that. Danny might have even told him and his partner himself. He can't remember. He goes through the accumulated crap in the glove compartment. Weird how it piles up, expecting to find nothing, and nothing is what he finds. Jalbert wouldn't have put anything in there. Not once he saw it was where Danny kept his phone. The center console strikes him as more likely, but there's nothing there either. Although he does find a bag of M&Ms he meant to give to Darla Jean the next time she showed him an A paper. DJ gets lots of A's. She's a smart little thing. He looks in the side pockets. Nothing. He looks under the passenger seat and finds nothing. He looks under the driver's seat. And there it is, a glassine envelope containing white powder that can only be cocaine, heroin, or fentanyl. Kansas is hard on hard drugs, Danny knows. The kids get lectured on it at assemblies all the time. This is too small an amount to be considered with intent to distribute, but in Kansas, even possession is a Class 5 felony which can get you 2 years in jail. Does Jalbert want him in prison for 2 years, 90 days in county more likely, on a drug charge? No, but he does want him in jail, because then he can work him, and work him, and work him. The guards might work him too, if Jalbert asked. Behind the seat is a space where all sorts of crap accumulates, including a crumpled McDonald's bag. Inside the bag is a hamburger wrapper, and one of those cardboard sleeves that once contained a fast-food fried apple pie. It's just the right size. Danny picks up the envelope of dope by the sides and slides it in, bending the sleeve so the envelope won't rub, blurring any fingerprints that might be on it. Prints are unlikely, but possible. He puts the cardboard sleeve back in the McDonald's bag and puts the bag in his dinner bucket. When he goes back to the school, Jesse is at the picnic table. "Be with you in a bit," Danny says and goes inside. He puts the bag on a high shelf in the storage room behind some cleaning supplies. Then he phones Edgar Ball. "Are you still my lawyer?" "I am until you need a pro," Ball answers. "This is interesting." They talk for a while. Edgar Ball promises to drop by the high school around 2 and to meet Danny at the KBI station in Great Bend at 6:15 that evening. Danny promises to give him a check for $400.
"Better make it 5, considering what you're asking me to do," Ball says.
Danny says okay. It's fair, but it will take a big bite out of his nest egg.
He calls Margie and says he may not be able to help out very much for a while because he lost his job. She tells him she gets it.
"Have those cops talk to me," she says. "I'll tell them you're a shouter, not a stabber. The idea of you killing anyone is flat crazy."
Danny says she's a peach.
Margie, 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 Bobargie to Stevie, says you're goddamn right I am. He takes his sandwich and thermos out to the picnic table and has a nice lunch with Jesse.
"I'm going to miss this place," Jesse says. "Weird, but true. and I'm going to miss working with you. You're a good boss, Danny.
You'll catch on somewhere, Danny says. I'd write you a reference, but you know, under the circumstances.
Yeah, Jesse says, and laughs. I feel you.
Edgar Ball shows up at 2:15. Danny gives him the check and the McDonald's bag.
Sure you want to do it this way? Ball asks. You'll be going out on a limb.
I'm already out on a limb, Danny says. Getting further out all the time. 36. They punch out at 3:30, half an hour before their usual quitting time. Danny locks up the school for the last time. All seven doors. Jesse gives Danny a man hug, and Danny returns it along with a couple of slaps on the back. Danny tells Jesse to take care of himself and stay in touch. Jesse says for Danny to do the same. Danny drives to Oak Grove, keeping an eye on the rearview mirror, looking for cops. He sees none. When he gets home, he finds a note taped to his door. It's short and to the point. Move out. We don't want you here. He pulls it off the door, tosses it in the kitchen trash, takes a quick shower, and puts on fresh clothes. Then he calls Ella Davis.
Danny Coughlin again, Inspector.
How can I help you?
Trust in me just a little.
Danny tells her what he wants her to do. She doesn't say yes, but she doesn't say no either. He sets out for Great Bend and has covered about 30 miles when a KHP cruiser pulls out of a farm road and comes after him, lights flashing. The trooper gives him a blurp of the siren, totally unnecessary because Danny is already pulling over and powering down his window. Once it's open, he puts both hands on top of the steering wheel where they can be seen. The trooper's name is H. Calton. He comes up to Danny with one hand on his Glock. The strap has been unsnapped.
License and registration, please.
My license is in my wallet, Danny says. I'm going to reach into my hip pocket and get it.
He does so, moving very slowly. Once he's handed his DL to Trooper Calton, he says,
Now I'm going to reach into my glove compartment and take out my registration.
Do you have a weapon in the glove compartment?
No.
In the center console?
No.
Go ahead.
Once again, in slow-mo, Danny opens the glove compartment and takes out his registration.
Do you have proof of insurance?
Yes.
He starts to reach for the glove compartment again.
Never mind the insurance card.
Sit still, Mr. Coughlin.
Calton goes back to his cruiser and gets on his radio. Danny sits still. 5 minutes pass.
He's going to be late getting to Great Bend,
but that's all right. Jalbert doesn't think he'll be there at all.
Having verified that the 2011 Tundra he's pulled over does indeed belong to Daniel Coughlin, a thing Calton already knew, Danny is quite sure, the trooper returns to the driver's side with Danny's paperwork. But he doesn't hand it over.
You know why I stopped you, Mr. Coughlin?
Danny says he doesn't.
You were weaving all over the road.
Danny knows that isn't true, but keeps quiet.
Have you anything to drink today, Mr. Coughlin?
If you're asking about alcohol, the answer is no.
How would you feel about a breathalyzer test? Willing to take one?
Yes.
How about drugs? Been using any of those? Pot? Ecstasy? Cocaine?
No.
Would you consent to a search of your truck?
Don't you need a search warrant or something for that?
Not if I have observed you driving in a dangerous manner. You can consent to a search, or I can impound your vehicle.
Okay, Danny says, opening the door. I have an appointment, so I guess you better search. Trooper Calton makes a show of searching the cab, saving the underside of the driver's seat for last. He spends a long time looking under there, even getting his flashlight from his cruiser. Then he slams the door and gives Danny a flat look.
What about that breathalyzer? Danny asks.
Sir, are you being smart with me?
Danny can't tell if the cop's cheeks are flushed or if it's sunburned.
No, but I wasn't weaving, and we both know it.
I'm going to write you up for reckless driving, Mr. Coughlin.
I wouldn't do that. Danny says. If you do, I'll see you in court, where my lawyer will ask if you spoke to Inspector Jalbert of the KBI prior to pulling me over. Then you'll have to decide whether you want to tell the truth or commit perjury, which might or might not come back to bite you in the ass. Do you want that? Kelton takes a minute while trying to decide if he wants to push this. It's not sunburn, definitely a flush. Danny thinks it's nice not to be playing defense for once. Kelton hands him back his license and registration.
Try to keep on your side of the road from now on, sir.
Danny almost pushes it a little farther, almost asks if Kelton doesn't at least want to give him a warning, and decides enough is enough. Kelton is armed, and he still hasn't snapped the strap over the butt of his service weapon.
I will, officer. Get out of here.
Kelton follows him for 5 miles, almost riding Danny's bumper, then turns off. The rest of Danny's trip to Great Bend is without incident. 37. Edgar Ball is waiting for him at the far end of the KBI station's parking lot. He asks Danny how his trip was. Danny tells him about Trooper Kelton. Unbelievable, Ball says. Are you sure you want to take that dope back? It should be safe enough now. Jalbert took his shot. Danny hopes he's right about that, and also hopes he won't be arrested later by Inspector Davis. Ball opens the trunk of his car and hands Danny the McDonald's bag. Danny puts it in the center console, and this time he locks his truck. Let's go in, Danny says. Watch Jalbert when he sees me. That'll be interesting. But it's not. What they see is the barest flicker of surprise, there and gone. The room, equipped with audio-visual recording equipment, is crowded. In addition to Jalbert and Davis, there's a tubby bald guy named Albert Heller and a suit-wearing beefcake named Vernon Ramsey. Heller is the Wilder County attorney. Ramsey is a detective from Oklahoma City. With 6 people crowded in, the feel is downright claustrophobic. Somewhere in this facility, there's probably a more spacious conference room, but conferencing isn't what Jalbert and Heller have in mind. What they have in mind is breaking Danny down, now that he's here. Introductions are made. Hands are shaken. Danny and Jalbert forego this. The Miranda warning is given, this time by the county attorney. Heller finishes by announcing for the record that Mr. Coughlin has brought his counselor at law. Heller takes the lead, covering the same ground that was covered at Danny's last interview. They sit facing each other, with Edgar Ball on Danny's side of the table and Ella Davis on Heller's. Ramsey leans against the wall, face impassive. Jalbert stands in the corner with his arms crossed. Under questioning, Danny recounts his dream. He recounts his trip out to the abandoned gas station in Dart County. He recounts his clumsy attempt to make an anonymous report. When Heller asks why he called, Danny tells him about the dog. It was digging her up, chewing on her. I'm sure you saw the photographs. Heller tells him they need to know much more about where Danny was during the first 3 weeks of June. Danny says he'll help all he can, but he doesn't keep a diary or anything. When Heller runs out of questions, Vernon Ramsey, the Oklahoma City cop, steps forward. Did you kill Yvonne Wicker?
No.
Ramsey steps back. He has no follow-up questions. Jalbert whispers something in his ear and Ramsey nods, face impassive. Heller winds things up by telling Danny not to leave the county. Danny shakes his head. I'm actually planning to leave the county and the state. My name was printed in a free handout newspaper. I'm the prime suspect, and somebody wanted to make sure everyone in central Kansas knew it. Danny's eyes flick to Jalbert. Jalbert looks blandly back.
I can assure you no one involved in the murder investigation gave your name to the press, Heller says. That was unfortunate, but nevertheless it would be a very bad idea for you to leave the town of Manitou, let alone Kansas.
It would have arrest me, Danny says. If you want to keep me in Kansas, arrest me.
Heller stares at him. Ella Davis looks down at her hands, which are folded on the table. Ramsey appears to be studying the ceiling. Jalbert is openly glaring.
You can't, Danny says. You have no proof that I killed Yvonne Wicker because I didn't. I only reported the body. So don't tell me there would be consequences.
Actually, there would be, Ball says almost apologetically. A suit for false arrest, filed by me.
I strongly advise you to stay where you are, Heller says. Leaving would only make you look more guilty.
From the corner, in a mild voice, Jalbert says, he is guilty. Danny takes a folded piece of paper from his back pocket and hands it across the table, not to Heller, but to Davis.
It says, get out, you fucking murderer, or else. It was wrapped around a brick. The brick was thrown at the side of my trailer in the middle of the night. That's a consequence of getting my name in the paper, Mr. Heller. The well has been poisoned. He again flicks his eyes to Jalbert. The next brick could be at my head.
Ramsey says, where are you going?
I'm thinking Colorado. I have a brother there, and I don't see him enough.
It won't matter where you go, Jalbert says. Miss Wicker will follow you like a bad stink, one that won't wash off.
Danny knows this is probably true. He looks at Ramsey. Are you pursuing any other suspects? Any at all? Maybe a boyfriend she dropped and wasn't happy about? A bad home situation?
Ramsey says, the OHP Investigative Division isn't in the habit of sharing information with suspects.
Danny didn't expect any better. He has an idea that OHP isn't pursuing any suspects in Oklahoma, and for good reason. He thinks that there is no connection between Yvonne Wicker and her killer. She was hitchhiking, got picked up by the wrong person, and it cost her life.
He stands up. I'm leaving. No one stops him, but Jalbert says, you'll be back.
38. In the parking lot, Danny shakes hands with his lawyer who drove his big honker of a Honda from Manitou. He said very little, except for that zinger about suing for false arrest. That was a good one. Otherwise, what was there to say?
Are you sure you want to take a chance on Davis?
Ball asks.
Danny shrugs. You're thinking she'll arrest me for possession when I show her the coke? Compared to what's hanging over me, that's a minor risk.
Ball rocks back and forth on his feet. If you did kill her, you're the most divine liar I've ever come across. Even better than my Uncle Red, which I would have thought impossible.
I didn't, Danny says. He's getting tired of saying it.
39. It's only a couple of miles from the KBI station to where he's supposed to meet Ella Davis. But Danny goes the long way through Great Ben's paltry downtown, checking his rearview mirror, doing his best to make sure no one is following him. When he finally arrives at the coffee hut, it's 8:30. There's a paved parking area in front, dirt in the back. That's where Danny parks, pulling up next to a RAV4 sport utility. He's pretty sure it belongs to Davis. There's an action figure on the passenger seat that he recognizes. Thanks to Darla Jean. It's Elsa Oldenburg from Frozen. He goes inside. Davis is in a booth around the corner from the counter where she can't be seen from the main parking lot.
I didn't think you were coming, she says. I was getting ready to leave.
I wanted to make sure I wasn't followed. Sure as I could, anyway.
She raises her eyebrows.
You really are paranoid, aren't you?
It was for your benefit as well as mine. I don't think Jalbert would like you meeting me behind his back.
She's spared a response by the arrival of a waitress. Danny, who hasn't had anything to eat since his sandwich at lunch, orders country ham with gravy and a Coke.
That will clog your arteries, Davis says when she's gone.
Beats a brick in the head.
Frank Jalbert thinks you wrote that note yourself. He would. Why are we here, Danny? I've got a babysitter and her meter's running.
Danny tells her about Jalbert's visit to the school, ostensibly to inform Danny he needed to make an official statement, also to show him the picture of the grieving Wicker family and the Oklahoman. But he had another reason. I wouldn't have known if Jesse, the kid I work with, hadn't mentioned that Jalbert parked out back when it's only steps to the front door from the faculty parking lot, which is empty in the summer. That made me suspicious. I checked and found a little envelope under the driver's seat of my truck. He slides the fried pie sleeve across to her. It's in here. Might be heroin, but I think it's coke. For the first time since he's met her, Davis's professional veneer cracks. She lifts one of the sleeve's end flaps and peeks inside. I handled the envelope just by the sides. I doubt if he left any fingerprints. He's too smart for that. But on the off chance he slipped up, you might want to check. She recovers smartly.
Let me get this straight. You're accusing Frank Jalbert, 20-plus years, a KBI inspector, half a dozen citations, including two for bravery, of planting drugs in your truck.
I'm sure he's a hell of a cop, but he's convinced I killed that woman. Only that's not right, not enough. He's obsessed. And if you haven't seen it, I'd be very surprised.
You could have planted this on yourself, Danny.
I'm not done. He tells her about the bogus highway stop and how Trooper Calton spent most of his time looking under the driver's seat. He skimped everything else because he knew where it was supposed to be. And as far as planting it on myself, ask Jesse Jackson about Jalbert parking around back. He'll tell you. The waitress is coming with Danny's food. Davis sweeps the fried pie sleeve into her purse with the side of her hand. When the waitress is gone, Ella points at his plate and says, "That looks like something the dog sicked up." Danny laughs and digs in.
"There! Now you sound like a human being."
"I am a human being. I also work for the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, and that makes me a doubting Thomas. Jalbert gave my name out to that rag, Plains Truth. You say you're as obsessed with him as he is with you." "I have to be. He's trying to nail me for a crime I didn't commit. And what can I do to fight back? Let out the air in his tires? Slap a kick me hard posted on the back of that black coat he wears? Only talk to you. And that's a risk. My lawyer said you might arrest me for possession."
"I'm not going to do that."
She watches him eat and twiddles at the small gold cross she wears around her neck. "Let's say, for the sake of argument, that Frank gave out your name to the one outfit that would publish it and that he planted cocaine in your truck, assuming it's not talcum powder or mannitol. Just for the sake of argument, let's say that. Do either of those things prove you didn't rape and murder Yvonne Wicker?"
"Not in my book."
"Danny can't argue that."
"I will get what's in your little envelope tested, and I'll talk to that guy at Plains Truth, Anderson. Text me your young assistant janitor's number and also get in touch with him. Now I have to go." She starts to get up.
"That little gold cross, is it just for show? Or are you a believer?"
"I go to Mass," she says warily. "So you can believe in God, but not that I had a dream about where Wicker's body was. Have I got that right?"
She touches the little gold cross briefly.
"Jesus performed 30 miracles, Danny. You had one dream, or so you say. The check's yours. I just had coffee."
Danny says, "Lady, you don't know how much I wish I'd never had that fucking, no, that motherfucking dream." Ella Davis pauses. She's almost smiling.
"You're an engaging guy, Danny. Reasonable. Friendly. At least that's the face you show the world. What's underneath, I don't know. But I'll tell you a secret."
She bends over him, fingers splayed on the table,
little gold cross swinging. I'd like to believe you. Maybe I even could, except this is the only goddamn psychic dream you've ever had. Why you? I ask myself. Great question, he says. Guys who win the lottery probably ask themselves the same thing, only this is the opposite. I don't know why me. It's easier for you to believe I killed her, isn't it? By far. Do me one favor. Be careful of Jalbert. I think he might be dangerous. It isn't just planting drugs or giving out my name. That counting thing is bizarre. I looked it up. It's called arithmomania, she says, then looks like she wishes she could unsay it. She leaves without looking back, that big purse of hers swinging. The waitress comes by and says, save room for blueberry buckle, hun. I'll try, Danny says. 40. On his way back to his hotel, Jalbert uses a burner phone to make a call. There were no drugs in his truck, Calton tells him. Not under the seat, not anywhere. That's all right, Jalbert says, although it's not. He found them and got rid of them, that's all. Like a wolf smelling a trap. As for you, troop, you know nothing, right? You just stopped him because he was weaving. That's right, Calton says. It might be smart to delete this call. Roger that, Inspector. Sorry it didn't work out. I appreciate the effort. Jalbert ends the call and puts his burner back under the seat. He'll hold on to it for a while, maybe another 10 days or so. 5 plus 5, 4 plus 6, etc. Then trash it and swap it out for another one. Does Coughlin know he planted the drugs? Of course. Can he do anything about it? No. The police would say he planted the blow on himself. But finding it, Jalbert didn't expect that. Coughlin really is like a wolf, one that can scent a trap no matter how well it's concealed. He'll kill again if he isn't stopped. He must be stopped, not just for poor Miss Yvonne, but for other girls who might be unlucky enough to cross his path. And if he goes to Colorado, Jalbert thinks, we could lose sight of him. Animals know how to hide, how to fade into the brush. He has to be stopped here, in Kansas. Arrest me, Jalbert whispers and brings a fist down on the steering wheel. Bang! The arrogance, the insolence. But you know what, Mr. Coughlin? We're not done. A long way from done. He thinks of Coughlin's face. His constant open-faced denials. His gall. Arrest me. Jalbert needs to settle himself so he can think about his next move. He needs to count. 41. The clerk at the Celebration Center is browsing a weird-ass catalog called What on Earth? He's currently considering a t-shirt that says, For bears, people in sleeping bags are soft tacos. He's interrupted by a guest striding up to the desk. And not just any guest, that KBI inspector. He looks mad, too. Really mad. Face all red right up to both sides of his shaggy widow's peak, which has been disarranged in a way that's almost comic. Not that the clerk feels much like laughing. The inspector's eyes are wide and bulgy, sort of bloodshot. The clerk shoves the retail porn catalog under the desk's overhang in a hurry and asks how he can help. The chairs are gone.
What chairs, sir?
The folding chairs. I had 4 folding chairs from the conference room, or business center, or whatever you call it. I had them set up just where I wanted them, and they're gone.
Housekeeping must have...
I had the Do Not Disturb sign on my door,
Jalbert shouts. A woman on her way to the gift shop gives him a startled look.
Those signs are pretty old, the clerk says, wondering if the inspector is armed. Sometimes they fall off and the chambermaids don't see.
The sign didn't fall off. Jalbert doesn't actually know if it did or not.
He is too upset. He was looking forward to those chairs.
I'll have someone get...
Don't bother. I'll do it myself. Jalbert makes an effort to lower his voice, aware that he's gone a little over the top, but still to come into his little suite and find those chairs gone. It was a shock. He goes down to the business center and takes 5 chairs. Only 2 in one hand and 3 in the other feels wrong. Unbalanced, he debates taking a 6th or putting one back. It's a hard choice because he keeps thinking of Coughlin, how insolent he looked when he said, "If you want to keep me in Kansas, arrest me." Then the crowning, infuriating touch, "You can't." Infuriating because it's true. Only for now, he thinks. Jalbert decides on 4 chairs and counts steps back to the elevator by 4s under his breath. 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3, 4. He knows the counting thing is peculiar, but it's also harmless. A way to soothe counterproductive thoughts and clear the mind. He's up to 9, 2, 3, 4, when he reaches the desk, a total of 36. To the clerk, he says, "I was out of line. I apologize."
"No problem,"
the clerk says, and watches Inspector Jalbert walk to the elevators. He seems to be muttering under his breath. The clerk thinks that it takes all kinds to make a world. To him, this is an original thought. He thinks it would look good on a T-shirt.
42. In his boxy Kansas plane suite, Jalbert sets up the chairs and runs them. He knows he's been doing it a lot lately. Maybe too much, but it helps. It really does. And maybe he was doing it a lot even before Coughlin. Maybe it's a problem. The chairs and the counting. He's aware that numbers rarely leave his mind these days. Adding them, dividing them, and it may be an addiction. Sometimes when he's counting, a number will pop out of his mouth like a jack from its box. It happened with Calton, and although he can't remember for sure, it could have happened with the clerk downstairs. Certainly the clerk thought he was being peculiar about the folding chairs. He ought to do something about it before it gets out of hand. Maybe hypnosis? And he will, as soon as Coughlin has been charged with the murder of Miss Yvonne, but in the meantime he needs to plan his next move. Counting helps. Running the chairs helps. He goes from a folding chair to the bed, which is 4 steps. From the bed to the closed seat of the toilet, which is 11 more. That's a total of 15, 1 to 5 added sequentially. Next, to the chair by the desk in the sitting room. That's 14 more, which makes... For a moment, he has no idea what it makes, and a kind of panic sets in. Poor Miss Yvonne is depending on him. Her family is depending on him. And if he can't remember a simple arithmetical total, how can he possibly... 29, he thinks, and relief floods him. His upset is all Coughlin's fault. "Arrest me," Jalbert murmurs, sitting bolt upright in one of the folding chairs. "You can't. You can't." Coughlin leaving the state? Jalbert can count all he wants, but he didn't count on that. How can he, Inspector Frank Jalbert, keep the pressure on if Coughlin simply folds his tent and leaves? He counts. He adds. Occasionally he divides. The idea of killing Coughlin comes to him, and not for the first time. He's sure he could get away with it if he was careful, and it would save the girls who might suffer poor Miss Yvonne's fate. But without hard evidence of Coughlin's guilt, or a confession, even better, the son of a bitch would die an innocent man. Unacceptable. Jalbert goes from one room chair to the next, to the bed, to a folding chair, to the toilet seat, to another folding chair. He lies down for a while, hoping to sleep, at least to get some rest. But when he closes his eyes, he sees Coughlin's insolent face. "Arrest me. You can't, can you?" He springs up and begins running the chairs again. "Last time," he tells himself, "then I'll be able to sleep. When I wake up, I'll know what comes next. On the toilet seat, he covers his face with his hands and whispers, I'm doing it for you, Miss Yvonne. All for you. Which is a lie, and he knows it. Miss Yvonne is beyond help. Danny Kaufman is alive and free.
43. On Saturday morning, Ella Davis drives to Manitou. Her daughter is strapped in the back seat, absorbed with the iPad mini she got for her birthday. Ella told Danny Coughlin that she had a babysitter and the meter was running. That was a lie, but she doesn't feel bad about it. He is lying about Yvonne Wicker, after all, and his lie is bigger than hers. Are you sure he's lying? Totally sure. Ella and Lori are staying with Regina in Great Bend. Reggie has a daughter just Lori's age, and the birthday party was actually Reggie's idea. She's crazy about Lori, and is delighted to keep her when Davis has to work.
100% sure.
She tells herself she is. She's less sure that he called in the location of the girl's body out of remorse and a desire to be punished for his horrific crime. He would have confessed already if that were the case. She thinks now that it's a kind of arrogance. He's playing chicken with us, she murmurs. What, Mommy? Nothing, hon. Are we almost there? 3 or 4 more miles. Good. I'm beating beer pong. What pong? I used my finger to throw the little balls into the cups of beer. When they go in, there's a kersploosh, and I get points. That's nice, Lori. She thinks, beer pong. My 8-year-old is playing beer pong. She thinks, what if he's telling the truth? What if there really was a dream? It's the same story each time, without significant variations and without the liar's tells that she's been trained to look for. A shifting of the eyes to the left, a wetting of the lips, a raising of the voice, as if being loud would convince her of the truth. He doesn't over-explain either, and risk getting tripped up by his own lies. Is it possible he's even convinced himself? That his rational mind, horrified by what the alligator deep inside did, has constructed its own alternate reality? Is it possible he's telling the truth? This morning she called the Jacksons in Manitou and asked Jesse if he would be willing to talk to her. He said yes without hesitation, and here she is, turning into the Jacksons' driveway. She isn't here because she believes Danny about the dream. She's here because she almost believes him about Jalbert. If Frank's been doing what Danny says he's been doing, it could very well screw up any chance they have of making a case. More than that, it's wrong. It's bad policing. Her unease about her partner is growing. She's almost ready to be angry at him. Bullshit, you're angry at him already. True, she says. What, Mommy? Nothing, Lore. Mrs. Jackson is hanging out clothes. A little boy who looks to be Lori's age is on a swing set nearby, singing that awful Baby Shark song. When Davis opens the back door and lets Lori get out, the little boy hops off his swing and runs over, examining the newcomers. Lori stands close to Ella, putting one hand on her mother's leg. Mrs. Jackson turns to Ella and says hello. Hi, I'm Inspector Davis. Here to see Jesse? He's just in the house. Jesse! Your company's here. The little boy says, I'm Luke. Is that an iPad mini? Yes, Lori says. I got it for my birthday.
Radical.
My name is Lori Rose Davis. I'm 8. Me too, Luke says. Want to go on the swing? Lori looks at Davis. Can I, Mommy? Yes, but be careful. Don't break your iPad.
I won't.
They run for the swing set. Pretty girl, Mrs. Jackson says. I'm the mother of boys. I'd pay to get one of those. She can be a handful, Ella says. Try Luke, you want a handful. She goes back to hanging clothes.
Jesse comes out of the house, dressed in jeans and a plain white tee. He walks to Davis without hesitation and shakes her hand.
Happy to talk to you if it's about Danny.
Tell you up front, though, I don't think he did what the cops say he did. He's a good man.
Davis has heard this several times now, even from Becky Richardson, Danny's sometime girlfriend. Richardson wants nothing to do with him now, of course, but continues to say that he seems like the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet, and Richardson believes the dream story.
It isn't Danny Coughlin I want to talk about, at least not directly, Davis says. Is it true that Inspector Frank Jalbert came by to see him at the school yesterday?
Yeah. I didn't like him.
Oh? Why?
He's made up his mind. I could tell just by the way he looked at Danny.
Well, she thinks, I have too, right?
Danny says you saw Inspector Jalbert park around back.
That's right. Why?
Did he park near Danny's truck?
No. By the school buses. That's pretty close.
Hey, did he put something in Danny's truck? Try to set him up?
I wouldn't put it past him.
He looked totally locked and loaded.
Did you see him put anything in Danny's truck?
No.
Did you see him go to Danny's truck? Kind of looking it over? You know, the way some guys look at trucks?
No. Soon as I saw him get out of his car, I told Danny. Then I went back to work. Danny said just because it was our last day, that was no reason to be slacking off.
I'm sorry you lost your job because of Coughlin.
Jesse's face darkens.
Wasn't him. Chicken shit school administration said Danny had to go and I had to go with him. They made up a lot of bullshit reasons.
Jesse, watch your mouth, his mother says. This is an officer of the law you're talking to.
It just makes me mad. They probably made up some stupid stuff on account of they couldn't fire him because of that girl. Whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty?
I keep hearing that, Ella thinks.
He went, so I had to go, Jesse says. I get that. I'm just a kid, but I needed that money for college.
You'll get another job, Davis says.
Already did. At the sawmill.
Jesse makes a face.
The pay is better, so long as I don't cut off a hand.
You better not, his mom says. You need that hand.
Lori and Luke have abandoned the swings. They are sitting in the shade of the small yard's only tree, heads together, looking at the iPad mini. As Davis glances their way, the two kids start giggling at whatever's on the screen.
Davis is suddenly very glad she came. After spending so much time with Jalbert, it's like coming out of a stale room into fresh air.
Let me get this straight, Davis says, taking out her notebook. You saw Inspector Jalbert park in back.
Yeah, even though our front is a lot closer to the building.
But you didn't see him approach Danny Coughlin's truck or touch it in any way.
I told you, I had to go back to work.
Okay, understood. She smiles and gives him her card. If anything else occurs to you...
You should have seen him, Jesse bursts out, waving that newspaper in Danny's face. Low class. After Danny did the cops a favor. I don't think that guy even cares who did it. He just wants to put Danny in jail.
Enough, Jesse, his mother says. Show some manners.
That guy Jalbert didn't show any,
Jesse says, and Davis guesses that was true, but excusable. When you've got a rapist murderer standing in front of you, manners have a way of going out the window.
Thank you for your time.
Come on, Lori, we have to go.
We just got here,
Lori groans.
Me and Luke are playing corgi hop. It's so funny.
5 minutes, Ella says. Her ex claims she spoils the girl, and Ella supposes he's right. But Lori is what she's got. All she's got. And how she loves her. The thought of Coughlin putting his dirty, blood-stained hands on her, on any girl, makes Ella cold.
Mrs. Jackson, can I help you hang those clothes while I wait for them to finish their game?
If you want to,
Mrs. Jackson says, sounding both surprised and pleased.
The pins are in that mesh bag.
The two women finish up fast, hanging the last two sheets as a team. Davis thinks about Jalbert parking near Coughlin's truck. She can't believe that Danny Coughlin dreamed the location where a murdered girl was buried. But she is closer than ever to believing that Frank Jalbert, a decorated inspector, planted drugs and then got some cop to stop Danny on the road to Great Bend. She just can't prove it any more than they can prove Danny Coughlin killed Yvonne Wicker. Let it alone, she tells herself as she puts the last pin on the last sheet. Probably good advice, but she won't do it. If Jalbert is over the line, she can't just stand by. And she has someone else to question. It will probably come to nothing, but at least she'll be able to tell herself she tried. You want a glass of iced tea? Mrs. Jackson asks as she picks up her laundry basket. You know, that sounds good, Ella says, and follows her toward the house. One thing she's sure of, this is going to be her last case with Frank. All else aside, Danny is absolutely correct about one thing. That counting business, the arithmomania, is spooky, and it's getting worse. 44. At 10:30 on Sunday morning, someone knocks on the door of Danny's trailer. He expects to see Jalbert or Davis, but it's Bill Dumfries, the retired contractor who put him in touch with Edgar Ball. He looks uncomfortable, arms crossed over his meaty chest, not making eye contact. Danny has a pretty good idea that he hasn't come to invite him to dinner.
Hey, Danny.
Hey, what can I do for you? Dumfries sighs.
There's no easy way to say this, so I'm just going to come right out with it. Most of the people in the park think it'd be good if you left.
Danny is already planning to leave, which should make this all right. Sort of all right, but it doesn't. You want to come in and have a cup of coffee? Talk about it a little?
Better not.
Dumfries glances toward his trailer, and Danny sees Althea Dumfries standing on the top step watching them, probably wanting to make sure Danny doesn't whip out his murder knife and start stabbing on her husband, which is funny in a way. Danny thinks if he made a move on Bill, the guy would break him in half.
There was a kind of meeting last night, Dumfries says. A flush is creeping up his neck and infecting his cheeks. People were talking about getting up a petition, but I said, screw that. I'll talk to him. Tell him which way the wind's blowing.
Danny thinks of his mother, who had a saying for every occasion. One of them was, it's an ill wind that blows no good. Here was that wind, and he knew the name of the evil sorcerer who had ginned it up. Angry as he was at Jalbert, Danny didn't want to do the man harm. That would make his situation even worse. All he wanted was to get away from his zone of influence. The sooner the better. You tell people not to worry. Danny gives Althea Dumfries a wave, restraining the urge to flip her the bird. She doesn't wave back. I'll be gone soon. You don't want me here, and I don't want to stay. My mother would say this just proves that no good deed goes unpunished.
You really didn't kill her.
No, Bill. I really didn't kill her. And the only one who's close to believing me is the lawyer you recommended. I don't know if you'd call that irony or not.
Where are you going?
Bill Dumfries doesn't need to know that Danny still hasn't nailed that down, but because Bill at least had the guts to face him, without eye contact, it's true, Danny closes the door of his trailer gently instead of slamming it in Bill's face. Back in his living area, he makes a FaceTime call to his brother, knowing Stevie will be on break. Stevie keeps to a regular schedule and gets upset if something happens to knock him off it. In that way, Danny thinks, he's kind of like a Sunnyside version of Jalbert. Stevie is sitting on a box of Charmin and eating a Twinkie. He brightens when he sees Danny's face. What's up, Danny Bobanny? I'm thinking I might move to Colorado, Danny says. What would you think about that?
Stevie looks both pleased and worried.
Well, maybe. But why? Why would you?
Tired of Kansas, Danny says, which is the absolute truth. Then he understands why Stevie looks worried and has stopped munching his snack. He's a creature of routine, is Stevie Coughlin. Routine keeps him safe. His motto is, keep the shiny side up, keep the rubber side down. He is the chief information officer at King Soopers, even has a plaque that says so, and he loves his room and his friends in the group home. I'm not talking about us moving in together, Danny says. I might not even live in Boulder. I looked at some places in Longmont, you know, online. Stevie breaks out a relieved grin.
Longmont's nice.
Danny doubts if Stevie has even been there. That's what I've heard, and rents are cheap. Well, cheaper. We could have supper together sometimes. Maybe hit a movie. You could take me on one of your hikes.
West Magnolia. Mud Lake. I could show you those. Great hikes. Wildlife. I take so many pictures, you wouldn't even believe it. Mud Lake. I know it's an ugly name, but it's really pretty.
I think it sounds great, Danny says, and adds something else that's nothing but the truth. I miss you, Stevie. Now that Stevie knows he won't have to forego the group home, and maybe Janet, he looks almost ecstatic.
I miss you too, Danny Bobanny. You should come. Rocky Mountain High in Colorado.
Sounds good. I'll tell you what's going on when I know more.
Good. That's good.
Give me one. But quick, my break's almost over. Once more, Danny is ready. King Oscar sardines. Stevie laughs.
End of aisle 6. Top shelf on the left, just before the end cap, 4-pack, $9.99.
You're the best, Stevie. They are lucky to have you. I know, Stevie says, and chortles. 45. On Monday, Jalbert is called to Wichita to make a report on the Yvonne Wicker case. Top brass will be present. Also the county attorney from Wilder County. Dart County doesn't even have a county attorney, Jalbert tells Davis.
Do you want me to go with you? Ella asks.
No. What I want is for you to press Coughlin on where he was during those blanks in the first 3 weeks of June. And you need to knock on doors in that trailer park. Talk to Becky Richardson.
I did.
He makes a chopping gesture with one hand, a gesture that's very unlike him. Talk to her again, and talk to her daughter. Ask if Coughlin ever made her uncomfortable. You know, touching.
Jesus, Frank.
Jesus what? You think what he did to Miss Yvonne just came out of nowhere? There will have been signs. Now, are you with me on this or not?
Yes, sure.
Good. 19.
What?
It's the only good prime number, Jalbert says, then makes the chopping gesture again. Never mind. Knock on doors. Find something. We can't let him leave Wilder County, let alone the state. I'll take care of Wichita.
Can you convince them to arrest Coughlin?
I'm going to try, Jalbert says, but don't hold your breath.
He leaves. Davis goes to Oak Grove and starts knocking on doors, although not on Danny Coughlin's. After their conversation at the coffee hut, she's not ready to talk with him again. Becky Richardson is home but on her way out, telling Davis she has to do a favor for a friend. She has nothing new to add anyway, only that she and Coughlin had a relationship and now are quits. The daughter, Darla Jean, stares at Davis from in front of the TV with big eyes. Ella makes no attempt to interview her. At 11 o'clock, after a series of fruitless interviews that have told her nothing new except Danny has agreed to leave the park, she calls Plains Truth. She half expects voicemail, but the phone is answered by a young man.
Yellow?
I'd like to speak to Peter Anderson, please.
That's me.
Mr. Anderson, I'm Inspector Ella Davis of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. I'd like to talk to you about Daniel Coughlin.
There's a long pause. Davis is about to ask if Anderson is still there when he speaks again, sounding younger than ever.
I was given a good tip, and I published it, okay?
If there was something wrong with giving out his name, I didn't know.
Ignorance of the law is no excuse, Davis thinks. But in this case, there's no law anyway, just accepted practice.
But if there's something wrong with the follow-up, I guess I could print a retraction. If it's not true, that is.
What follow-up, she thinks, and makes a mental note to pick up the latest issue of Plains Truth.
What I want to know, Mr. Anderson, is who gave you your information?
A cop.
Anderson pauses for a moment, then blurts.
At least he said he was a cop, and I believed him because he really had the inside track on the investigation. He said printing the guy's name would put pressure on him to, you know, come clean.
This mystery cop didn't give